You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Welcome to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Now, your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And we are back with the May 18th, 2020 version of the M Squared TechCast, or mitechnews.tv. Right here at podcastdetroit.com and wherever fine podcasts are distributed. We've got a great show for you today. Some interesting guests as usual. Mike, why don't you kick it off with our first guest?
We have calling in from Seattle, I believe, Nathan McDonald, a managing partner and CEO of Karitsu Capital. How are you, Nathan?
I'm doing great, Mike. Great to be with you guys.
My daughter and my ex-wife live out in Seattle. So how's the weather out there?
Well, just beautiful spring-like, and boy, we are itching to get out and about here. So it's been tough this last week having to continue to shelter, but we're looking forward to getting the covers off here soon, hopefully.
Yeah, we were just talking about that too in Michigan. Go ahead, Matt.
So. I was just wondering, is that at the end of the month for you guys, or what is going on there in Washington?
We seem to be destined to be last. We were first, and we will be last. So I don't know. I think the people are going to push things ahead here pretty soon. There's already more people out and about. Being safe, but, you know, it's still hard to kind of figure what we're doing here. It seems like day by day, step by step, we're continuing to let more things go. And, but yeah, I think, June 4th, I think is when we're supposed to go to the next phase of the reopening. We're in the first phase right now.
Okay. I think ours is Memorial Day, right, Matt?
Well, Governor Whitmer here in Michigan just announced the opening of some businesses again, retail, bar, restaurant, at reduced capacity with social distancing protocols in place. That's going to start Friday, which I don't think coincidentally for the tourism economy in Michigan that's so important to this state. That's the start of the Memorial Day weekend. So, you know, basically everyone in Detroit gets on I-75 or I-96 and goes north and west for that weekend. So, you know, I won't be among them this year, but, you know, I would bet it's going to be pretty busy.
So let's talk about the 900-pound gorilla in the room, COVID-19. And from your point of view, what is the short-term impact of startup funding for COVID-19, Nathan?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. I've been on a few shows here, and the answer's kind of changed week to week as we've had to deal with the situation over the last couple months, you know, everyone going through the initial adjustment period and then one of the quotes from our portfolio companies, in the midst of crisis lies great opportunity, you know. And so we've from Albert Einstein, a lot of inspiring quotes here, and the entrepreneurs in our portfolio have been very inspiring in how they pivoted and really adapted to the change and been able to, you know, in a lot of ways take advantage of it now and being able to be more efficient in their operations. But, you know, short term, it created a lot of uncertainty and we weren't quite sure what was going to happen, but as we've seen in the public markets with the amount of liquidity that's been pumped in, there's a lot of capital out there, and people have learned through the last couple of corrections that, you know, this is the time when you need to keep your heads up and be looking for opportunities, look for companies that have an opportunity to really benefit from the current situation. And, you know, it's a great way to put your capital to work in addition to everything we can do with our time and efforts and staying safe and staying home.
All right. Well, what do you think of the long-term impact? You know, when we finally do get some kind of treatment or a virus or something, how do you think that's going to change things?
Yeah, I'm not sure if long-term is weeks, months, or quarters at this point, but, you know, yeah. It feels like June is a long time away at this point. And, you know, I just had someone drop off a birthday gift for my daughter here that she was at a party. It was just 2 months ago, but it feels like a lifetime ago. So, you know, our whole perception of time and everything has really been thrown off on this whole thing. And I think it's going to continue into the future in that some businesses are going to continue to see an acceleration. And those are typically technology companies that can operate independent of a retail location that don't have to meet face to face with clients or have alternative means of doing so. And you're going to see a continued hit to the, you know, 15% of our economy, which unfortunately employs like 40% of our workforce, they are going to continue to have some significant headwinds. And I think, you know, the transition for big box retail and a number of the wounded brands that were already out there are going to continue to see headwinds and tough times ahead. Whereas those who have been more innovative and more technology forward are going to be the ones that are going to win and come out of this in the long term. So it's just really accelerated a lot of the existing trends towards technology adoption throughout the economy. And unfortunately, that means the big companies are going to keep getting bigger and really at the expense of a lot of the Main Street operations that may not have the technology sophistication to keep up.
Well, I was already reading stories about the retail apocalypse even before any of this happened, right? So, and when you have people like the CEO of Taubman Centers saying, you know, there used to be 3,000 malls in this country, and now there's 2,000, and there probably only need to be 800 or 900, you know, that's going to be a big deal regardless.
Exactly.
Yeah, all those little mom and pop operations, 1, 2, 3 people that they've poured their lifetime savings into, they're the ones really at risk, I think, at this point. So let's talk a little bit about getting back to the when is that going to be, right? But let's, you know, try to be optimistic and say, what are you doing to prepare for the market after the lockdown ends that we can deal with short term, right?
Yeah, I think that's the real opportunity for entrepreneurs out there that have raised capital, that want to raise capital. It's really looking hard at your business, your core focus, and really looking at into the future and what is that new reality going to look like. And in some cases, it removes a whole set of barriers to distribution, barriers to entry, because it eliminates a whole string of competition that was out there before and really brings everything into a center platform. So it's a very interesting dynamic time, and it's been great watching our entrepreneurs react to the situation. We had our annual meetings a couple weeks ago where we looked at 100 different portfolio companies and how they'd reacted to the situation. And by and large, they were quick to make sure they adjusted their business focus and their core operations to make sure that they extended their runway if needed to, or, you know, cut off the things which aren't as essential. You know, in any business, right, we're spending 80% of our time on the things that actually aren't that important. And so, you know, now that we don't have extra time, it's really focusing on our core customers and making sure that we're able to sustain and be profitable. And so that when things do improve and things get back to, quote, normal, you know, these are the companies that are going to thrive and be able to grow. So, you know, on one hand, survival is a goal this year. And then survive to thrive is the mantra that we live by.
All right. Well, what's the new investment thesis? What's the new investment theme that the pandemic has given us?
Yeah, it's interesting when you look across industries. You know, if you look at real estate, it's quite a dynamic time, to say the least, with, I think, a lot of real challenges ahead in the debt market around commercial real estate and what it's going to happen as places return to work and some of those valuations and pricing models get thrown into flux. If you look in the life science area, you know, obviously huge funding and huge need to bring our healthcare system into the 21st century here, into the current technology state of the art, which has just not been done because it's so fragmented. So huge opportunities there to improve healthcare delivery, healthcare tracking, data management, giving the consumers more control. And then when we look at information technology, again, just continued adoption of technologies and being able to manage remote work, manage real workforces, going beyond the physical footprint to really, you know, being able to recruit globally for your team and be able to take advantage of the benefits for that. And we think there's going to be a big acceleration in the fintech and in the Bitcoin cryptocurrency area. As we've seen with our federal government sending out hundreds of billions in stimulus money to everybody, putting in an application, you know, there's ways to do these things easier and make sure they are validated. And we've got a huge unemployment fraud issue here in the state of Washington that they're dealing with and actually had to shut things down for a couple of days. So there's really easy fixes with technology to some of these legacy problems. And I think there will finally be the willpower to actually adopt these technologies and bring things forward, which I think, you know, ultimately set us on a better course and bring some of these innovations that haven't quite had the opportunity to get into the market will become more of the expected state of the art.
Yeah, certainly. I think accelerating the remote workforce video world kind of whole thing. And of course, Zoom hasn't exactly been hurt by all this. I think that's one of the few stocks that has really taken off, right? But there are a lot of other alternatives out there besides Zoom. But I think in general, a lot of people have been wanting to work remotely for a long time and just haven't been able to talk their bosses into it. And now this is this great experiment. And so I think they've discovered that, well, a lot of these people can work from home, and that really changes the dynamic quite a bit.
Or at least work from home part of the time. That's what I think is going to start happening.
Yeah, the chance to get outside of the, you know, we had already seen the kind of Northern California reach capacity and the Silicon Valley kind of exodus. That was already going on, has been going on for a couple of years now. And just the price and just, you know, squeezing more into the Silicon Valley isn't the answer for prosperity for our whole country. So we'd seen a lot of people obviously been moving to Seattle, been moving to Bend, been moving to, Denver and Boulder and other places like that. And we just continue to see a big acceleration of that, which I think is very healthy for our overall economy to be able to spread that technology and that workforce out, you know, across a much greater, you know, quality of life, quality of community, and just to more integrated. So I think long term, I think it'll continue to be very healthy to see that distribution of the technology workforce instead of the continued concentration of it, which has been the trend for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about the background of Keiretsu Capital. How did that company get started, and how has its focus evolved over time?
So Keiretsu is a global community of entrepreneurial investors who built and sold multiple companies, you know, and we want to recycle that expertise and mentor and support the next generation of entrepreneurs. So Keiretsu Forum is 55 chapters globally, about 3,000 members, and we collaborate around due diligence and screening opportunities and then syndicating and really learning from each other's experiences. And then Keiretsu Capital was set up about 5 years ago for our members to be able to invest in funds that would be diversified across companies that had due diligence completed and were syndicating and finishing off their rounds of funding. So it's hard to get a lot of data on the angel investing experience and activity. So this was one way for us to capture a set of opportunities, now invested in over 100 companies over the last 5 years, and been able to track their progress and also work with family offices and corporate investors and really create that coordination and support across our investment community. And we're very happy to have a chapter in the Midwest there as well, in Chicago and Ann Arbor and Cincinnati, and encourage anyone who's interested to look at getting your capital put to work. There's a lot of people want to do impact investing and want to be involved and help. Again, everybody can help, and even, you know, 10, 15, 20K of investment can make a big difference for these companies. So I encourage everyone, if it's something appropriate, take a look at it and see if it's something that could be a good way for you to also help investing in some of these companies that can really benefit from the situation and help improve the quality of the response that we're making to this situation.
Well, we're getting close to the end of this segment, so this would be the point where you get to make your shameless plug. How do people get a hold of you if they want more information, either on the investor side or the investee side?
Yeah, appreciate anybody who's interested in funding the future. KeiretsuCapital.com, KeiretsuForum.com, and LinkedIn's a great way to connect as well. So appreciate the opportunity to be with you guys, and hopefully we'll get a chance to have some of our portfolio companies come on and speak a bit about some of the things they're doing with their technologies to address the challenges ahead.
Yeah, that'd be great. All right, take us out, Matt.
All right, Nathan McDonald, Managing Partner and CEO of Keiretsu Capital. Thanks for being with us today. We'll be back in just a minute with another segment of the M-Squared TechCast. For right now, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
Watching at PodcastDetroit.com and a whole bunch of other places.
See graduates earn a degree and a higher starting salary. In fact, when it comes to earning potential, the Brookings Institution ranks LTU fifth among U.S. colleges and universities. Be enriched. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
As a Lawrence Technological University graduate, you're not only marketable, you're worth more. Yes, more. According to payscale.com, when it comes to graduate salaries, LTU is in America's top 100. Be invaluable. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Hey, it's Matt Roush.
And Mike Brennan.
And we're back with another segment of the M-Squared TechCast, mitechnews.tv.
And we have calling in from sunny Miami, eat your heart out, Michigan, Andrew Saltz. We were talking before the show started about the miserable weather we've been having way up north. But I imagine it's a lot nicer in Miami, right?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I have to complain about is that the beach is closed.
Oh, poor baby. Okay. All right, let's talk a little bit about what you guys are doing. Now, you have a company that's really involved in artificial intelligence. Why don't you kind of introduce everybody to what your company's name is, what they do, that sort of thing, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, so our company, Evolve, we sit at the intersection of artificial intelligence, life science data, and biologic therapies. You guys may have heard a lot about antibodies, so we actually focus on training computers on how to discover antibodies. And we really put patients at the center of our mission about accelerating how healing is delivered and discovered. I mean, accelerating healing is something we really need right now to allow us to leave our homes, to protect the people at risk, to restart the economy, and really to help affect the those affected by the coronavirus, whether it's patients or healthcare workers. And so we use AI to reduce the time it takes to discover drugs and really significantly reduce the failure rates in pharma, which are over 90%.
Wow. The antibody tests in particular, nobody really knows if they've had COVID-19 or not. And so they're urging everyone to get one, but no one seems to be able to find where they can get one, sort of that circle thing. But it's good that you're doing that. So that how has AI helped you in that particular area?
So we're on our end, we're not actually focused on the diagnostic side. We're actually focused more on therapies. But this is what you're talking about in general is actually a really big challenge. So science takes time, right? And so running these experiments, running them in the laboratories, they actually take a lot of time and they cost a lot of money. So in general, the average amount of time it takes for a drug to go from the laboratory into patients in the doctor's office is anywhere from 10 to 15 years. We don't have that amount of time to deal with the coronavirus. But when we see all these failures that are happening, you've been hearing about these diagnostic tests not working very well. It's because we're really trying to move way faster than the science is proceeding. So we're constantly getting new information from research labs about the coronavirus. And every day there's like now 30 papers coming out about the coronavirus. So being able to have that information when these diagnostic tests are being developed, you know, it takes time to actually study them. So with artificial intelligence, what we do is we actually try to generate and fail as much as possible in the laboratory. And so, I'm sorry, in the computer. So, and that by doing that, by failing in the computer where it's fast and cheap, we're lessening the likelihood of failing in the laboratory or in the animal studies or in the doctor's office or in the clinical trials where it's way more expensive and causes way more risk.
Matt?
Okay, interesting. You know, we've heard a lot. We've been hearing about artificial intelligence for years. You know, it's kind of been overhyped in some ways. You know, I still can't talk to my HAL 9000 computer like I would to a person. And maybe that's a good thing in view of what happened. But you know, how do you define AI, and you know, what do you see as its promises and shortcomings?
Yeah, there's this really great quote that from an economist, and it said that nobody wants a drill. What they want is a hole, right? So I think a lot of people when they talk about AI, they say it in terms of like the idea of a drill, this thing that's going to change the world. It's like, you know, but like if you give a drill to a 6-year-old, they're going to think of it's like a ray gun. And if you give it to somebody who's super experienced in it, they're going to have to be able to the capability to do something with it. So really, I think one of the big challenges about sort of the demystification about AI is less about thinking about what it can do and what its practical implications are. So, you know, not thinking about it as some smart machine or some theoretical statistical algorithm. And the way that I think about it is, you know, the way that we think about it actually at our organization is really, you can use AI to automate. Right, so it's turn like a manual task into something that can be done automatically by a machine. You can use it to assist, where we can now you're moving into the ability to support someone's mental capabilities. So think about like a calculator multiplying really large numbers. It's not to say you can't multiply them, but it's just easier. We can use it to analyze. So when you're talking about, you know, business intelligence, where you see graphs from a on a pie chart, or really when you're talking about big data. when looking at 80 billion data points. And there's no human mind can handle that capacity. The other thing is really, can you accelerate things? Can you really predict what's going to happen? And we see a lot of that in the social media, where you're getting this predictive advertising, or in finance, where you're trying to predict the value of things. And then all of this comes together and really trying to augment humanity, right? Making humanity better, right? So a calculator augments your ability to multiply. It doesn't replace it per se. And so that's what, when I think about AI, I think about, can we replace the word, the artificial in artificial intelligence, with automated intelligence, assistive intelligence, analytical intelligence, accelerated intelligence, augmented intelligence. And so really think about the practical implications of it, rather than just sort of this mystical tool like HAL, right? HAL 9000. So really thinking about it in the practical implications of the whole that it generates, not what it is as a tool.
Yeah, we had HAL 9000, he'd probably eject you out of the house, Matt, and you'd be exposed to all this COVID-19 contagion, right?
So, I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Anyway, so evolve. How do you see evolve evolving, and along with AI, where's this going?
Yeah, so there's this really long value chain in pharmaceuticals, right? And by the way, our name is spelled EVQLV, and there's a reason why it's spelled that way. We have a video on our website and our YouTube channel explains where our name comes from.
I was wondering where the Q came in.
Yeah, it's an interesting fact that actually has to do with science. So I'm not gonna go too far into it, but basically it has to do with evolutionary algorithms and antibodies themselves, which are made up of amino acids. But you can go to our website and see the video where our name comes from. But in terms of the value chain of pharmaceuticals is generally, you go from a target. So I'll use the coronavirus as an example. The coronavirus is actually in some cases, it's the target of the disease. Of the medication, sorry, not the disease. It's the disease that's the target. So in cancer, there's many, many different types of cancers, and they all have different targets that one might go after. So that's sort of where drug discovery starts from. Then you actually have to discover a drug to target that disease, and you have to optimize that drug to make sure that you can manufacture it, that it works in humans. Then we've got to test it in animals. Then you apply to the FDA to be able to do human trials, and you do three phases of human trials. And if that all works, then you apply to the FDA to get approval. And then at that point, the drug actually goes into doctor's offices where they can prescribe it to patients. Today, we're actually focused on drug discovery at Evolve, using AI for drug discovery. But there's all sorts of practical implications that we can use it for: accelerating animal studies, accelerated human studies where you're optimizing the patient selection, and even doing target discovery, because a lot of times we don't actually know the causes of diseases. So we think our view is that we can actually apply artificial intelligence to each phase and turn that 10 to 15 year process into something that may be 5 years or even shorter. So over time, our goal is to apply AI to those various different parts of the drug discovery and development process. And that's how we're going to be evolving our company. Okay. I mean, we're technologists at heart. So our team is 80% data scientists, data engineers, structural computational biologists. And so we're a technology company applying life science. Similarly, like Uber is not a taxi company. They're a livery company, but they're a technology company applied to moving people around. They weren't a taxi company adding technology on top. And so that's how we think about things. And we think it's a little bit different.
So as a practical matter, what do you actually do for a pharma research lab? What would be your typical engagement? What would that look like?
Yeah, so what we do is, if let's say, for example, a collaborator has a particular target that they want to go after, we've actually in our computer, we've modeled evolution. So we actually can recreate the way evolution occurs. Now, when your body responds to if someone gets the coronavirus, you've heard about the antibodies that are formed in the body as a result, the immune response. You've heard about this before. Right. What's actually happening is that's actually an evolutionary process. That's a process. That's something that's been generated over the millennia or even longer of your body generating these antibodies. It's a mutational process. It has been through evolution. So we've actually modeled that in the computers. And we've actually modeled ways to discover whether a drug will actually work outside of that. So thinking about, like, is it stable at 98 degrees Fahrenheit? Why is that drug stable at 98 degrees Fahrenheit? Why is that important? Well, that's the average body temperature. So if you inject a drug, it's not stable at 98 degrees Fahrenheit. It's not going to work in the body. So those are some of the things that we do computationally. So we're predicting this stuff so we can fail in the computer. So that limits the laboratory failure. And so the way that we engage with our partners currently is that, because we're a fully computational company, we collaborate with companies that may have laboratories that actually produce the drugs that we generate in the computer. And so that adds, you know, that says, okay, we can make it. And now they can test it in the laboratory, which proves the scientific community at large that our, not only that our technology is working, but that actually these drugs are have enhanced values that allow them to move faster through animal studies and human studies. And so that's actually, so that's one of the, some of the ways that we actually engage with collaborators.
All right. So what is not artificial intelligence? You were saying a lot of people have this misconception of what artificial intelligence is, but it really isn't. So what would you say it is not, or what it can't do?
So, you know, it, artificial intelligence is actually the recreating or sort of recreating in the computer what human intelligence would be. And so I think the thing that I think what artificial intelligence is not, is it, I don't think it's like the Terminator per se. I think a lot of people fear that this sort of, that we're going to see this machines taking over our lives. And I'm really like, there's a big fear around that. I think that that's not what it is. And when you think about the HAL 9000, I mean, we're actually getting pretty close to that, right? I mean, there was a really funny joke that says like, hey, why don't you have Facebook? I said, well, I don't want Mark Zuckerberg saying that to my girlfriend. And I'm like, I don't want Mark Zuckerberg listening to me. I laughed, my girlfriend laughed, Siri laughed, Alexa laughed, right? So it's like, those are all forms of artificial intelligence. So artificial intelligence really is like thinking of, it's not specifically programming, which is a lot of things that people think about. It's not like if this, then that. That's just functional programming. To me, artificial intelligence is actually trying to predict the probabilistic nature of the way that we behave. So when you're crossing the street, and you see that there may be 7 seconds left to cross the street, you're making a decision based upon your statistical thinking of the way your brain thinks about, do I have enough time to cross the street, right? If, and maybe you get to 1 second, and maybe if you're like a lot younger, or you don't see any cars coming, you're just going to run across the street, or, you know, like you're going to make that move. That probabilistic decision-making is actually something we can program into computers. But it's oftentimes very narrow. So there's like this, there was a research study that came out fairly recently that said that machines have gotten better at reading breast cancer scans than radiologists. But the thing is that it's actually really good at reading a certain type of scan. But if you have these anomalous scans that like no one's really seen before, where it's not like a very common cancer, like ampullary cancer, the machine's not going to be that good at it because it's not very good at picking up anomalies. And it's sort of like what you think about when we all try to figure out what's going to happen after the coronavirus. We don't have any historical information, even internally to ourselves, to try to understand what the new normal is going to be like. And so computers are actually that have that similar challenge. If they don't have enough data that they're trained on, historically, they don't have any ways of predicting. And they're not really good at doing, they're not intuitive. Machines are not intuitive right now. And we actually, as humans, actually have really good intuition. So I think understanding that is, and sort of not try to classify everything as AI, really, sometimes it's just like, well, it's a computer. You know, it's a computer solution. It's not, or maybe it's a mechanical solution. It's not AI as a solution.
Okay. So it reminds me a little of my occasional interactions with tech support on the phone, where if your problem isn't one of the 10 ones on their list, you're pretty much screwed. It sounds like AI could be a lot like that.
Correct. And if you think about it, if you think about like, if you've tried to interact with these automated systems, right, like how terrible it is, right? Like speak your number, speak your name. And like how many times you have to say that? And in the end, you're just like customer service, customer service, customer service, right? Until somebody comes on the line. That's actually, that was the transition into AI, right? That's try to transition. I remember getting on, trying to do a call like that with Apple not a long time ago. And I actually made it all the way through without ever speaking to a person. I was so impressed, right? So you can sort of see the difference between like what people try to think is AI and what it actually can do. And I think we have these middle grounds where we have to transition, and it's painful to transition. So.
Andrew Seltz, we're going to have to leave it at that. We're running out of time in this segment. We'd like to have you back on the show here later this year if you're interested.
I'd love that.
Hopefully the weather will be nicer in Miami, so you can get to the beach, right? So
and you can come down to Miami.
Oh, okay, perfect. I like it. So, all right, take us out, Matt.
All right. Well, thanks very much for being with us today. We'll be right back with another segment of the M Squared TechCast. For right now, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're watching MITechNews.tv.
Lawrence Technological University graduates earn a degree and a higher starting salary. In fact, when it comes to earning potential, the Brookings Institution ranks LTU fifth among U.S. colleges and universities. Be enriched. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Lawrence Technological University is all about opportunities. You learn beyond the campus, doing real-world research for top companies and honing your skills through co-ops and internships. Apply what you learn. Be challenged. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Hello there, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And we're back with another segment of the M Squared TechCast.
And we have Kaylin Green calling in. I'm not sure exactly where you're at, Kaylin. Where are you at?
I'm actually just outside of Tampa, Florida. So another Florida.
Another Floridian. Gosh, you know.
Oh, okay.
Don't say anything about
our beaches are open.
It's all upset, you know. So we've had lousy weather up here. So anyway. You have some an interesting company that you're working with or that you've created called Sanitation Pod. Why don't you talk a little bit about that first?
Yeah, hi. Well, my name is Kaylin, and I actually am a teacher. So I have my degree in elementary education. And as you know, we've all been affected. I'm sure some of you parents are just going crazy homeschooling your kids at home. And I was linked up with my friend out of China. He's a big movie producer. I have some background in the entertainment industry as well. I came in third place on the Discovery Channel to have my own show using science to prank people. And while I didn't win that, I made a lot of great, you know, networks and with people in the science industry as well as the entertainment industry. Mm-hmm. So my friend, his name is Tiger Miller. He's a huge movie producer out in China. He approached me with his technology, the sanitation pod technology. I actually have a picture of what I'm talking about. If you can see that, I'm going to get you guys this so you can, you know, more clearly show your viewers. Mm-hmm. But this, it's by CleanTech and BioM out of China, and they have implemented this in the Hong Kong airports. So this is going to basically change the way we travel. You're going to see these popping up in other airports. But there's other applications that I wanted to just create some exposure for.
Could it be used in hotels, places like that, or going into stadiums? That'd probably take a long time if you want to go into a stadium, right?
Well, and that's what we're kind of trying to start the movement with, is opening up other sports. Just out of England right now, a lot of the soccer clubs have purchased these to restart their season. So at least the players can feel safe,
right,
and, you know, start their season up. And as you know, Tampa is the host of the Super Bowl this coming year. And
hopefully.
Hopefully. And that's what we're trying to do, is implement these with big sporting events. Anywhere that people congregate, universities would be huge, schools, stuff like that. But basically, it's a pod where you walk in, it completely kills 99.9% of all the viruses, and it should help. I mean,
how long does it take to actually work? You just walk in, walk out, or you have to stay in there a while, or what?
The entire process takes about 1 minute. So if we're looking at a stadium size, they would need multiple units.
I'm in Ann Arbor, where the University of Michigan has a stadium that seats 110,000. Somehow I think that would take a bit of time to go through that, right?
Yeah, it would take a little bit, but at least we could focus on getting the players to go through these and they can safely.
Yeah, that would be the logical
reopen
thing.
I mean, their season.
I actually think that's what baseball's been talking about. That, and I understand the NFL's talking about, they have to, they'll just play the game in empty stadiums and make sure that the players themselves are safe.
Yeah, and that's what the UFC has been doing currently. And like I said, in Europe, the soccer clubs have just purchased these in hopes to resume their season.
Huh.
So how does it work? Is it ultraviolet light? Is it ozone? Is it some of both? Or,
well, when you walk, before you can even walk in, there's a temperature check. If you pass the temperature check, you walk through the pod, and it's a negatively pressurized system. So you walk in and it's all antimicrobial padding, and it used UV rays as photocatalysts and nano needles to basically electrocute and puncture all these bad viruses and get rid of them. So it completely sanitizes everything on your clothing. So if you're on a plane for 5 hours traveling, mm-hmm. people are coughing, it, you know, it's landing on all your belongings at every surface. So you walk in, it sanitizes everything, and you walk out in a minute and you can go to your families and have a higher level of safety.
So this could be at airports so that you could actually, I don't know if we're ever going to get back to 100% full planes again, but it could be used to get more people flying again, right?
Yeah, and it's unfortunate we're seeing these $20 each way deals, and there's so much fear associated with this. Nobody even wants to get on a plane.
Right. Yeah, see Paris and die, right, or something, you know? So
yeah, exactly. And this could be used, I think, in schools or, you know, with children out of school right now. And they were saying that even in the fall that they may not reopen. And parents, it's like, oh, my gosh, I cannot homeschool another semester. I just can't do it. So this is a purification system. They have just even the sanitizing liquid that you can sanitize the classrooms, or even taking the children out into the world. I don't even like taking my kids to the grocery store with me. So, and the kids are staying home, going crazy, driving us crazy. It's just something that can be a new technology that I just want to create some exposure for.
Yeah. Well, what it sounds like is a sort of human scale version of these things I'm seeing that'll sanitize your cell phone. I'm seeing those sold online now too. It's a little chamber that exposes your phone to ultraviolet light and you know, sanitizes your phone that way. And they sell for about $60 or $70. What is the price point on these at this point?
These right now they're not expensive. They're running about $60,000, and that's a drop in the bucket for, I mean, even retirement homes, so you can go visit your loved ones and not, you know, fear that you're going to pass on the virus.
I'm assuming once, if these got into an economies of scale, the price would come down, because right now they're making very few, but as they make many, I would imagine the price would drop, right?
Correct. And right now we're producing about 10 units a day, which is actually a higher scale, but if this could be taken more globally, obviously the price point would come down.
Sure. Is this something that they'd be willing to license to other manufacturers, or do they want to produce it themselves?
As of right now, it's being produced in China, but I'm not sure on that question. I don't want to give any false information, but we're trying to license it with the NFL right now.
Right.
And the NHL, just to at least get these seasons open so we can go back to our American culture of enjoying, you know, just some football on TV.
Yeah, it does seem kind of weird. You can't watch any sports that's real. I guess now, over the weekend, I guess NASCAR did a race with nobody in the stands. And so that may be the new normal for a while. Who knows, right?
Yeah, for a bit anyway, I would think. I mean, they get 2/3 of their revenue from TV rights and commercials anyway. So 2/3 is better than nothing, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. So how is it living with two kids at home for what, two months? And these are small children, right?
Yes. My son's in kindergarten. My daughter's 3, and wow, they're driving me nuts. But I've been using a lot of science experiments to engage them. I have one right here, just a basic, but technology iPads have been great. But just even like a little vortex experiment,
ooh,
gets the kids, you know, excited, and then you can let them play with it and you might get 10 minutes to yourself.
Ah. Yeah. Well, I know my executive producer, Kate O'Hara, is working on developing a Women in STEM network, so we'll have to get back to you on that. So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me. And
so what's give us a little background on the inventor of this, I guess, this Ty Miller that you talked about from China.
Yeah. Yeah. His name is Tiger Miller. I met him in the entertainment industry in LA. He's a movie producer on like multi-million dollar budgeted films. He works with the Kardashians. He's done a lot of their TV shows. He's very well connected in the entertainment industry. So his platform with this is he's trying to reopen even Broadway, the filming world, everything. So we can just go back to our lives that we're used to.
My wife and I were just talking about this yesterday, about what are we going to do for TV shows in the fall, because nobody's filming right now.
Lots of reruns,
This is the time of year they would be doing that, you know, for distribution starting in August and September, and nobody's working. So,
With this sanitation pod, I mean, they could have them on every studio in Hollywood or across the world, wherever you want to film. And at least same as with the sports, at least the actors and the film crew can go to work safely and without the fear.
All right. So what else you want to tell us about what you're working on in lovely Tampa there?
I'm working on everything. I don't know.
Let's talk a little bit
with my two kids and not go crazy.
Yeah, I can understand that. I'm going a little crazy myself, and I live alone. So, but anyway, so let's talk about it. Folks want to reach out to you and get information on how they might acquire these sanitation pods. How would they do that?
Email is the best way. You can look up the company. It's BioM online, and that'll give some information about the air purification and sanitizing liquids and procedures that we use. But my email is Kaylin, it's C-A-I-L-I-N, Green, G-R-E-E-N-E, at hotmail.com.
Okay. So why don't you take us out, Matt, and then we'll go on to Fred. We'll brighten our day, right?
Yeah. Kaylin, thanks for being with us today. We'll be right back with another segment of the M-Squared TechCast. For right now, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're watching the M-Squared TechCast on PodcastDetroit.com.
What do you get at Lawrence Technological University? Everything. Great labs and studios, supportive professors, plus a full campus life, NAIA athletics, and all the software you need to succeed. Be smart. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Lawrence Technological University graduates earn a degree and a higher starting salary. In fact, when it comes to earning potential, the Brookings Institution ranks LTU fifth among U.S. colleges and universities. Be enriched. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
Oh, and Mike Brennan.
And we're back.
I knocked over
Mike didn't know we were back, but we're back with another segment of the M-Squared Podcast. And we have with us, you know, it's funny. I had a telehealth appointment with my doctor on Thursday to get some prescriptions refilled. And he asked me out of the blue, so when do you think we ought to reopen Michigan? And I said, well, once R0 gets down below 0.5 or 0.6 or so. And he was like, how the heck do you know about that? And I said, it's because of my buddy Fred Brown that I know about that.
That's an excellent answer. I'm so happy about that. That's great.
I was able to impress my doctor because of you, and I'm grateful to you. But we've got a bunch more things. Fred, for those who don't know, is an epidemiology and infectious disease expert who's been working on this stuff since the 80s. And he knows more than anybody else that I know of about all this sort of stuff. So let's start, first of all, about an hour before we went on the air today, Governor Whitmer reopened, I think it's 37 counties, all of the UP and a few counties in northern Michigan, including Traverse City, I heard, retail bars and restaurants on a limited basis. They have to operate at 50% capacity. But what do you think based on the numbers up there?
So I've been obviously watching Michigan pretty carefully. I don't consult to Governor Whitmer. I do consult to a number of other about 17 other governors and four countries. So I can go into that if you like. You know, she's been very careful. We're one of only five states that still has really not opened yet, particularly and then most of the states, of course, have opened. And I think she's doing an excellent job overall. What she's looking at is the data, and the data shows that we're really good on the weekdays and not very good on weekends.
Yep.
So, sadly. So when you sort of look at the curve.
It sounds like my drinking habits, actually, but that's okay.
Yeah, and Sundays are, you know, nice weather on weekends just hurts us, it turns out. So that's where the data is. The limited opening, it's smart. So there's two things she's doing. One is she's looking at geographic, which is smart, right? You want to kind of go to the areas of geography that are a little bit less dense. There's about an 8-to-1 correlation between infection rate and density. So you want to go to the less dense areas. And then you want to look at the activities in those areas. So she's thinking about, okay, you know, here's the density levels. They're not very high at all in the UP, one of the best parts of the country in period. You know, Montana, the UP, those are the sort of places you want to be generally, unless you bring a lot of people there and then you've got problems because they all congregate in one space. But if you're out in the open, it's pretty safe. I would say that the 50% rule is a little bit arbitrary. What's more important actually is the density rule. So you really want to be able to keep people who are visiting spaced at least 6 feet, and you want to have ventilation. Those are the key, some of the key factors. And of course, hygiene is really important. So those rules make a lot of sense, but you also want, when you go personally to those places, I would look at a few things. Number one, if you can stay out on the porch, stay out on the porch. Don't go inside if you can avoid it. Yeah. Pick it up and go to a nice picnic place. You know, there's some nice things you can do and still have a great time. Number two, I'd look at their hygiene levels and make sure that, you know, they're really thinking pretty carefully about wiping down surfaces, keeping things clean, washing their hands pretty regularly, make sure there's signage. Number three, I'd make sure they're socially distancing successfully. So, you know, are they... do they have you 6 feet away from each other? Are you properly spaced away? And are they wearing masks? And if those things are generally in place, that's a really good sign. I would even though it's at 50% capacity, if you're in a tight area without any ventilation, no one wearing masks, and not able to distance, I would probably stay away from that one. Go to another one, or get something for pickup and take it out into the. And, you know, and have them pick it up, have them drop it off for you in front of their door, and you pick it up, pay them, and go off to a nice picnic table.
Now, what someone needs to do is make a mask that has a straw at the front of it, and then you put a cap on the end of the straw, and you only take the cap off when you put it in your beer.
Mike, I already have 5 of those on order, Mike. They're out there.
Dave's on top of this already, you know, so...
All right, so let's talk about the Moderna announcement about the admittedly very small clinical trial of a vaccine. What do you think is going on there?
Well, so some good news that so Moderna's in the lead. There are about 9 companies right now that think they're going to be able to get into phase 3 trials, say October, November, and then phase 3 trials. Those are the ones you really want to start to watch. The phase 1/2s are not so interesting, but this is a phase 1. Moderna started this, I think, on March 16th, as I recall. First person was injected, so you can get a sense of how long it takes. They want to enroll 45 people, which they've done. And what they found was that when they went and looked at 8 of those people, there were a few things. Number one, they had 3 different dosing. They had 25 milligrams, 100 milligrams, and 250 micrograms. Micrograms. So very small dosings. What's interesting, we got a dose response. So that, you know, on the smaller numbers, 25 micrograms, we have a similar kind of level as someone who would have been affected. At 100 micrograms, that dose, actually, you had significantly more antibodies than people who were infected did. This is only for 8 subjects. So they only opened up things up for 8 subjects because they don't want to ruin the power of the experiment. But 250 micrograms, actually, it was too much of a dose and people got sick. So they know, okay, we want to be between 25 and 100. They've asked to open up another arm of 50 micrograms, and that indicates to me they're probably not sure that 25 micrograms is enough. And then, on the other hand, you don't want to have to dose people up to 100 because then you have to make twice as much. You know, if you're able to work at 50, you do the math, and you know you got to make tons of this stuff to inject 7.8 billion people. So if you can keep the dose down, that's a good thing.
All right. So is there any real positive news out there? I know this is certainly opening up Northern Michigan and what we're doing on the drug trials. Is there anything, any kind of positive thing we can talk about out there?
Lots of good. I mean, there's some really good things, actually. One of the things we found is that we don't have an immediate spike. which was something, you know, that epidemiologists were a little bit worried about. Texas is having some challenges, and I do consult to Texas, and, you know, we're a little worried about Texas because they had over 1,000 cases over the weekend and new cases, and that's and they're obviously a big state. But they don't really have the testing density that we need in order to really judge, you know, whether or not it's a significant burst or whether or not we're just sort of unlucky. On the other hand, places that I was worried about, you know, like Georgia, which has a big airport, you know, I was concerned people were going to fly in like they did to Singapore and then start flying all over the country and spreading. They, you know, the mayor of Atlanta has been real careful. The distancing's been good, and there's been, you know, it's been nice and steady. Michigan has been, as I said, weekends we have troubles. Weekdays we're doing great. Weekends we have troubles. Weekdays we're doing great. So, you know, we're sort of going up and down. I understand, you know, we must be tearing our hair saying, we're like this close, but it's not quite ready yet, apparently. But yeah, so the good news is that we've had a lot of, we have 48 states opening, and so far, no major spikes with the, you know, we're watching Florida pretty carefully and a couple other states pretty carefully, but right now, things looking pretty good, which is great news, obviously. And what we're really worried about is the period of time in about, you know, 3 to 5 weeks after opening. At that point, we'd expect to see a spike if there's going to be one. But that, you know, that, so the good news is the social distancing worked, pushed things down. We didn't overwhelm our health system. And now we're slowly opening up carefully. And it looks like, you know, for the most part, things are going pretty well.
What about getting back on an airplane again? You got to be a brave soul to do that now. Because as you know, when you're in coach, they just jam you in there, baby. You're out on top of each other, which is the exact opposite of what probably needs to be done. How soon before we can resume any sort of, I guess there's some air travel going on, but pretty empty planes, right?
Yeah, it is. You know, if you look at long haul flights, which are the most difficult ones because you're in there for an awful long time, you got about 95% down. So, you know, Cathay Pacific, Singapore Airlines, those guys are really down in terms of, because you don't want to be in a flight that long. Plus, they got connecting flights afterwards generally to get to the place you really want to go. And all of a sudden, you're talking about a lot of exposure. So that's down, as I said, you know, 25%. 2 weeks ago, we were down 83% in domestic flights. Now we're at about 27%. Really? So of capacity. So, you know, it's people are taking some risk. I would say a couple things. First, I wouldn't do it unless I absolutely had to. You know, a business trip isn't a big enough reason. I mean, you're talking about a life and death, real big issue. Then I would consider flying.
Or a funeral or something like that.
A major life-changing event. Sure. Then, you know, okay. Think it over.
Visiting the grandkids isn't good enough, right?
You can take a car. Yeah. And don't stop. If you do stop, you know, don't use the restroom in the bathroom. Go to a hotel. You know.
Right. Using bathrooms at the rest stops. Ooh.
Oh yeah, don't do that. Don't. A lot of aerosols. You don't. Not a good idea.
Yeah.
You do fly on a plane.
You didn't want to do that 6 months ago. You want to do even less now. So.
Yeah, even less now.
That's right. So one of your talking points here, Fred, I noticed was 77 degrees. What does that mean?
So originally, the WHO did some experiments that showed the coronaviruses were a little bit suppressed. And I'm talking, you know, a little bit, not. I'm talking about, you know, 0.05 of an R, which, as you guys know from the graphs, is not.
That's right. We got much. That down. Yeah.
You know, it's a little bit to hope for that it might make the difference every once in a while between an outbreak and keeping something down. So the temperature and the humidity does help us, but it's just a little bit. But 77. So watch for 77. Don't get overly enthusiastic, but just understand that, you know, it's getting better for us at that point. Generally, I've also been working with a couple of businesses, and if you like, I can kind of talk to you about some of the things they're doing in order to manage opening, if that's helpful.
Yeah, very sure. much so. Absolutely. That is the big question right now. Is other than the bars and the restaurants below the Traverse City area, how does a regular business reopen?
Yeah, so there are a couple of things I do. You know, the first thing I do before you reopen is kind of understand where you are. I put yourself through a financial stress test because I think some of this is going to be longer than people think, and so I don't want to be ready with. If you're a small business, you want to be ready with cash and try to, you know, at least apply for all these opportunities that are out there with PPP and so on. Talk to your talk to your lawyer about liability issues, both with your customer and as well as with your employees, to understand, you know, what the legal issues are. Talk to your accountant about, you know, extending the payables and really trying to cut the receivables down. Look at your customer base. And I think the biggest issue is going to be, the biggest challenge is going to be actually stimulating demand. If you're already in a situation where you've got great demand, which is some of the companies that I'm working with, they were PPE companies. And so they were really interested in actually expansion, not just, you know, contraction worry, but you want to look at your demand, understand who your best customers are, what your contract requirements are, and hit those first. You might want to think about scaling back a little bit to the core of your business, so you don't have to carry quite so much inventory, quite so much complexity in the space. And then it gets really interesting. Then you actually have to look at your employees and you have to say, you know, how big a risk is it? Am I sort of a group of guys who are older and more susceptible, or am I, you know, have a pretty young workforce? And, you know, in this case, our group, the group I was working with, was an older workforce, which was quite isolated, but in a large group community. So there's a lot of communication and potential for the disease to go fast if we had problems. So what we did then is we actually said that here are the guys who are most at risk, and we actually tried to find different jobs for them, especially if they were doing jobs that, you know, required a lot of getting close together. And after that, we then looked at the processes. And the first process you got to worry about actually is getting back into the business, right? It turns out that it's kind of complicated because you want to test everybody, we heard about with a soccer with your soccer club. It takes time to actually process people through a testing facility, right? So you want to test everyone who's going into your manufacturing facility, make sure they're not bringing the coronavirus in with them. They had 300 employees. It took them an hour and a half to get everyone through the testing process. So you have to kind of stagger your processes and get people working in groups so that they, you know, and so they're not looking, they're not going to, you know, and interacting with lots and lots of different people in the factory, just the groups they need to work with in their team. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of separate the team. We had three shifts. So we separated the teams by about 15, 20 minutes. Now it means that you're not working at full capacity, but you're working at a real safe capacity. Cause right at that point we're working about 83% capacity. Not bad. But not obviously 100% where you'd like to be, but we only had one sickness in the last 3 months.
Yeah, so the auto industry is going back to work slowly. So yeah, certainly that's a manufacturing environment.
It is. Yeah. Well, one of the funniest discussions I had was this, there were two. They were, you know, office workers who were working in big office buildings, and they had to get, you know, 100 floors up on an elevator that only was a certain size. Mm. And, you know, we kind of calculated that really they need to make sure they could probably work with about 20% of their workforce at any given point. They just wouldn't be able to load the building up. So that was, well, one thing you want to do is one of the things we did in the manufacturing right away is we found space. And the first thing we did is we kicked out all the management and all the accountants and all the guys who didn't have to be in the facility. And we got about 40% more space that way. Mm. And then we were able to spread the guys out. You know, then all the workers had a lot more space. Everyone had an individual workstation, a high tech environment. So, you know, soldering boards and things like that. It wasn't quite like Ford and General Motors, but, you know, we then had the plexiglass shields up. So you isolate the individuals. They had to wash their hands 10 times a day. No exceptions. That we took to the bathroom, you know, in sequence, based on their shift schedules. And we also wiped down all the workstations every hour, and then every day we had a deep clean. So we were made, that was sort of the way we kept the hygiene up. We tried to improve the filtration system a little bit with the facility manager. So that was great. We actually eliminated some process steps. We duplicate, so some equipment they were sharing, we decided to buy another piece of equipment so they didn't have to share. We broke out all the bill of materials, look at all where they're going to have supply chain issues all the way along. We had about 900 different parts in that case. We had three different products, 900 parts, and then we had to figure out, you know, which parts are constrained. So, you know, there was a Swiss part that was constrained. There was a couple of semiconductors that only Malaysia would make. And so we had to really negotiate those constraint pieces really carefully so that the rest of our production facility still was able to keep going. And then we actually hired up some contract manufacturers where we thought they'd do a better job, you know, creating assemblages that we would then, we'd look at where we had the most value And then they would put together the assemblages for us. And we would then, you know, construct the final piece of equipment based on just, you know, three different pieces of equipment. So that was some of the, you know, some of the interesting things we did. You know, we tried to do the testing worked. We actually did tracing quite a bit. That's really important for the manufacturers, because I think manufacturers could actually, and good employees could be a safe haven for a lot of people, right? Because they'll have good policies in place. They'll have, you know, safe PPE in place. They'll have things in place that I think could actually make them some of the best performers as far as COVID prevention in the economy. So some of the things we did. What we found out was that there wasn't any one thing we could do to make everyone perfectly safe. But what we did is we actually created, you know, four or five layers of different protections. Social distancing was one, the plexiglass separation, the extra 40% space we had. Then we had the testing, you know, coming in, making sure people were clear before they came in. There was a self-test, a thermal test they did themselves, and then another test. And then, you know, we pull people that way. Then the masks, right? Masks did another 60%. They're not perfect, but they're 60%. Then we had the hand washing and the hygiene. Again, it's about 50% of safety, 50%. Not, but if you start to, you know, overlap 50%, 50%, 50%, 50%, all of a sudden you're getting a pretty, and that's what we do in hospitals too. I've worked with a number of hospitals who have a lot of employees going in and out, obviously in a very infected environment. And that's what we do. We kind of overlap lots of different protections and it gets pretty good.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it at that, Fred. We've run out of time, and Dave is getting ready to go back to the bar, so we don't want to slow him down.
Well, have a great time out there. It's great. I'm really happy we're starting to be able to open up and have people get some freedom again, because we have been cooped up, no doubt about it.
All right. Well, I am so ready. We want to thank Fred Brown for his visit here today. Thank the rest of our guests, Caitlin Green, Andrew Saltz, and we started off the show with Nathan McDonald from Kiretsu Capital, which is a great organization of angel investors. Mike, maybe we will be able to get together soon, a month or two maybe, and have a little visit and have a cool one maybe. So
that sounds like a great idea to me. So I couldn't be more ready if I tried.
We are kind of limping along, but I hope we're getting there.
Yeah.
All right. We'll be back at 2 p.m. Eastern time next Monday with another edition of the M-Squared TechCast. For right now, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you've been watching mitechnews.tv at podcastdetroit.com.
Thanks for listening to M-Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Join your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan, next Monday at 3 p.m. If you can't listen live, audio podcasts of the show can be found at podcastdetroit.com.